From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Margot Adler, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, actor, director, and writer Billy Bob Thornton. Two of his recent films are now out on video, Bandits and The Man Who Wasn't There. His movie Monsters Ball is out in theaters. Also, British cross-dressing comic and actor Eddie Izzard. He's playing the role of Charlie Chaplin in the new Peter Bogdanovich film, The Cat's Meow, set in 1920s Hollywood. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews When I Was Cruel, the latest CD by Elvis Costello, which reunites him with two members of his first rock combo, The Attractions. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. In eastern Germany, a 19-year-old student went on a shooting spree in a high school that left 17 people dead before turning the gun on himself. The BBC's Rob Brumby reports from Berlin.
It's the worst incident of its kind since the war. 17 people were gunned down. They all died before the killer, dressed in black, shot himself. The 19-year-old former pupil was expelled from the school just weeks ago. He prowled around the classrooms with a pump-action gun in one hand and a pistol in the other. Pupils trapped in his path used mobile phones to call for help. We're all crammed into one room, this girl says. The teacher is one of the dead. Everyone here is crying. A placard calling for assistance appeared next to a frightened face in one window as the siege continued. 15 of the dead were killed in the opening minutes of the shooting. Police described a scene of horror with bodies lying all over the school.
The BBC's Rob Brumby reporting. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has agreed to postpone the arrival of a fact-finding mission to the Jenin refugee camp. Annan has delayed the mission by one day. The panel is investigating allegations of human rights abuses during Israel's assault on the camp. Palestinians say hundreds of civilians may have died, many of them in dwellings flattened by tank fire and bulldozers. Israel says 48 people, mostly fighters, were killed. Still no resolution to the standoff involving hundreds of Palestinians inside the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. A Palestinian negotiator is set to consult with Yasser Arafat on ideas for a settlement. Four Palestinian policemen today surrendered. Meanwhile, Palestinian protests against Yasser Arafat's month-long confinement turned violent today in Ramallah. Israeli troops hurled tear gas and stun grenades at hundreds of people who were gathered outside. Boston's archbishop is denying reports that he will be reassigned over the scandal involving sexual abuse by priests. NPR's Scott Horsley has the latest.
Cardinal Bernard Law said through a spokesman there are no plans for him to be reassigned. The Boston Herald had reported Law would likely be transferred to a Vatican post sometime before a June deposition in a lawsuit over abuse by a former priest. Law was in Philadelphia at a fundraiser for Catholic University, where he heads the Board of Trustees. Law helped celebrate Mass at the Basilica here, while protesters outside called for his resignation. Meanwhile, Philadelphia's archbishop says U.S. cardinals are in agreement that even one-time sex offenders should be removed from all their ministering duties. Cardinal Anthony Bevilacqua stopped short of saying those priests should be defrocked. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Philadelphia.
The main stock indexes on Wall Street were lower today. The Dow lost 124 points. The Dow is down 346 for the week. The Nasdaq lost 49, and the S&P 500 down 15. This is NPR News. Many music fans are mourning the death of rapper Lisa Lopez. She was a member of the Atlanta-based trio TLC. The 30-year-old Lopez died late Thursday in a car crash. From Atlanta, Joshua Leves reports.
Lopez was known for her talent as a rapper, as well as the spunk and, some say, volatility she exuded. Known as Lisa Left Eye Lopez, she first gained fame when TLC made its debut 10 years ago. The group went on to sell millions of albums and win four Grammys. In 1994, Lopez pleaded guilty to arson in a fire that destroyed the home of her boyfriend, Andre Rison, of the Atlanta Falcons. After several years off, TLC got back together and released an album 2 years ago that helped make TLC one of the top-selling female groups in history. Lopez had public disagreements with the other members of the group and began a solo career. She also got engaged to boyfriend Rison. Spokespeople with her label, Arista Records, say she died Thursday night in a car crash while on vacation in Honduras. For NPR News, I'm Joshua Lebs in Atlanta.
A judge in Houston today refused to delay the Arthur Anderson trial on criminal obstruction charges related to shredded Enron documents. The federal trial is set to begin May 6th. Houston-based Enron in December filed for bankruptcy, then fired Anderson as its auditor. Anderson sought a 6 to 7 week delay for the trial, saying the company's been hurt by media coverage of the case. A California man faces up to 100 years in prison in a plot to kill fellow students at a college. Al de Guzman was convicted today on 108 counts of possessing and planning to use an arsenal of weapons against his fellow students at De Anza College. I'm Frank Stasio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, seeking to enrich community life through support of education, the arts, and culture.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Margo Adler, sitting in for Terry Gross. Billy Bob Thornton first became widely known for the 1996 film Sling Blade, which he wrote, directed, and starred in. He also co-wrote and starred in One False Move, received an Academy Award nomination for his supporting role in A Simple Plan, directed All the Pretty Horses, and co-wrote The Gift. His film Monster's Ball is currently in theaters, and his films Bandits and The Man Who Wasn't There have been recently released on video and DVD. Terry Gross spoke with him after the release of Monster's Ball. Thornton plays a corrections officer at a state prison in a small rural town in Georgia. He heads the team that handles the execution of prisoners on death row. His son has recently started to work on the team. They are preparing to execute an African-American prisoner. Thornton plays a racist, but he takes his job very seriously, particularly the ritual surrounding the condemned prisoner's final hours. In this scene, he's at a bar talking to his son, who made a mistake during the preparations for the execution.
It's when it gets time for us to do it, you know. You can't mess up. That goes for me, too, and the rest of them. You ain't no different than us. You can't screw it up. In England, they go as far as to give a guy a party the night before. Call it the Monster's Ball. They don't want no lawyer, no preacher, or anything like that around, so it's just you and me. Like I said, you can't think about what he did or anything else about him. It's a job. We have to do our job right.
When Terry spoke with Billy Bob Thornton earlier this year, she asked him to describe the place where he grew up.
I grew up in two towns. Until I was 8 years old, I lived in a town called Alpine, Arkansas, which is out in the middle of nowhere. It's in the woods. There's not really a town. It's just kind of this valley between all these mountains. And we were sort of the only literate people there. My grandmother had been a school teacher in the old days, you know, like the one-room schoolhouse thing. And my father was going to college on the GI Bill. He'd been in the Korean War. So we lived with my grandmother until I was, like I said, about eight years old or 9 years old. And my grandfather was a retired forestry worker, and he killed what we ate, pretty much, you know. Mm-hmm. Squirrel, possum, raccoon, you know, he would make turtle soup, all kind of stuff. We had no electricity, no running water, we had coal oil lamps, all that kind of thing. And my friends in California usually don't believe that. I mean, they think that that's only from the 1800s or something. You know, kids who are raised in Los Angeles, they just don't get that whole deal.
How old were you when you got electricity?
Well, when we moved into this other town of like 9 or 10,000 people, when I was in the third grade, that's when things started to. To us, it was like we'd moved to New York or something. You know.
Now, your mother is a psychic. And that apparently was the inspiration for your movie, The Gift. You wrote the screenplay. It starred Cate Blanchett as a mother and psychic who investigates a murder in her town that hits very close to home. What kind of abilities did your mother have, or does she have?
When I was growing up, you know, we got a lot of flack. I think it's in the movie, actually, about the kids getting a bunch of guff at school for it. People would call my mother a witch and things like that. And then a lot of people just dismiss it. But at the same time, everybody in town would come to see my mother, but they didn't necessarily want anybody to know that. So they would, I mean, especially men, they would see her in secret, you know, wouldn't want anybody to know that they did something as crazy or sissy-like as to go to a psychic. I mean, it was a very sort of redneck, male-oriented kind of society that I grew up in. But the thing about ESP, which is what my mother has, is it's not the way people think. You don't go to her and say, "Hey, am I going to meet a tall, handsome stranger?" And she says, "Yes, and it's going to be in October." You go and you talk to her. In other words, she feels things about people. She has instincts about people, and she will tell you when she gets around to it. But you can't just ask her a question and say, "Hey, is this thing going to happen?" She may not have that information for you, but she may have something else for you. Like, she'll be talking to you, and she'll say, "So, have you been thinking about buying a new car?" And you'll say, "No, I don't think so. Not really." And then you'll say, "So anyway, what about this big business deal? You think it's going to come through?" And she'll say, "Well, you know, it could. It definitely could. You're sure you're not thinking about buying a new car?" "Well, no, I haven't been." And then 2 days later, somebody calls this person up and says, "Hey, listen, I got this great GTO for sale, you know," and they buy this car. I mean, it happens that way,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, you called your movie about a psychic, The Gift. Did you grow up thinking that your mother had a gift and that certain talents were just gifts? There were things that you were just given. They came with you, and it was up to you to decide how to use it. But either you had that gift or you didn't. And did you think of yourself as having a gift?
Yes, but to answer the first part of it, I did think that people are born with gifts, absolutely. And I never really questioned all that. I always thought that if you had to try very hard to do something, it wasn't worth doing. And I still feel that to a certain degree. And people always talk about hard work and perseverance, but I think that the people with the creative side of the brain, I think those people are the ones, I mean, it was pretty obvious, they're the ones who are always daydreaming, they usually don't make good grades, they're always like, you know, they always have a bunch of weird things like, you know, well, like I've got phobias and different things like that. Usually just the more eccentric people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other people who are very practical, very hardworking, and that kind of thing. That was the world that I never quite understood. And although, I mean, both worlds obviously are valid and everything, but I just never related to that world. I always thought that you can either do things or you can't do them, you know? And I look at that way, and like, for instance, in marriage or relationships, you know, people always say, "Well, you know, marriage is hard work." My marriage is really not hard work. I've been married before when it wasn't that it was hard work, it's just that it was wrong, you know?
Right, right, right.
It just wasn't the right place to be. And there was no work to it. It was like, well, this is not the right thing. I shouldn't be here, and they shouldn't be here either.
You mentioned phobias.
Right.
If you don't mind talking about it, what are some of your phobias, and how do they affect your gifts? Considering your gifts include writing and acting, do the phobias interfere with those gifts?
Well, the phobias don't necessarily interfere, particularly when I did the movie Bandits. It was helpful. Because I played a guy with phobias. But, you know, my phobias aren't really that much of a hindrance in my professional life or anything. I have a fear of antique furniture, certain kinds of antique furniture that I can't be around. I can be around.
Wait. not a common fear. What's the problem with antique furniture?
Well, I just get creeped out by it. I can't be around it. And there's a lot of people have this sort of simplistic idea about what that is. They think, well, it's a past life thing, and you know, something weird happened to you at a certain time, and you know, whatever. Which I don't doubt that it's a past life thing. I mean, one friend of mine said maybe I was beaten to death with an antique chair, but.
Excuse me for laughing.
Oh, no, it's fine. You know, I don't know exactly what it is. It involves food, though. I can't eat around antique furniture. That's the main way it affects me. But anything Asian, I'm okay with. Like, if something is, like, centuries and centuries old, if it's Asian, I'm okay with it. But if it's, like, French or English or Scottish or something like that, I get so creeped out, I can't describe it. Like, my worst nightmare is, like, a castle with velvet draperies and things like that.
So it sounds like a Vincent Price movie to me.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. I can't be in a Vincent Price movie. I have an unnatural fear of Benjamin Disraeli's hair.
Strange, but...
Yes, yeah. Strange but true.
Billy Bob Thornton talking with Terry Gross. We'll continue after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to Terry's conversation with Billy Bob Thornton. His films Bandits and The Man Who Wasn't There have just been released on home video and DVD.
The film you were really noticed for was Sling Blade, in which you played is mentally challenged the right word now? You played a mentally challenged man released from an institution after serving 25 years for killing his mother and her lover. As you made clear when you hosted Saturday Night Live, everyone imitates you doing that part. How did you develop the voice and the character? You wrote the story, in fact, before the movie was made. You had a short film based on the same character, and I think you did him in a one-man show also.
Right. Yeah, the first thing I did was the one-man show. I'd written just the beginning, kind of what was in the short film that I did in the one-man show. I did that long monologue in the beginning there. It's based on life experience is really what it's based on, all of it. I mean, you know, the character of Carl in Sling Blade is based on a couple of different people. And I wasn't even conscious that it was based on them when I was writing it so much. It's like later on, it's like, oh, wow, you know. Matter of fact, my mother pointed out to me that part of that was like this guy that was in Alpine, you know. There was a guy who was kept up back of his family's house, and they, like, fed him sort of like a dog, you know.
Huh.
But the voice came about when I was working on a movie for HBO. And I was in the little sort of, you might call it a dressing room, that they'd provided for me. I had just a few lines in the movie. I think I had four lines. And they had peeled my head because the movie took place in the 20s. And I had this really stupid-looking haircut. And I just was in the trailer at lunch, and I was thinking, wow, you know what, I'm just a joke, you know. I mean, I was looking at myself, and I thought, I got four stupid lines on a cable movie here, you know, I'm never going to get anywhere. I was just kind of feeling sorry for myself, really. And I started making faces at myself in the mirror, you know, just to sort of, like, make it even more exaggerated. It's like, you know, it's almost like pinching a sore.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And so I made that face, and I started talking in that voice to myself. It sounds insane. Maybe it is. I don't know. But that's where I came up with that part of the character, the look and the voice. And then I said that monologue to myself in the mirror that day, that whole monologue. I don't know where it came from.
Why don't we hear that monologue?
Okay.
My daddy worked down there at the sawmill down at the planer mill for an old man named Dixon. But old man Dixon was a very cruel feller. Didn't treat his employees very well, didn't pay them too much of a wage, didn't pay my daddy too much of a wage. Just barely enough to get by on, I reckon. But I reckon he got by all right. They used to come out, one or the other of them, usually my mother. Feed me pretty regular. So I know he made enough to where I could have mustard and biscuits three or four times a week. Well, old man Dixon, he had a boy. His name was Jesse Dixon. Jesse was really more cruel than his daddy was. He used to make quite a bit of sport of me. when I was down there at the schoolhouse. Used to take advantage of little girls there in the neighborhood and all. They used to say that my mother was a very pretty woman. They said that quite a bit from time to time when I'd be down there at the schoolhouse. Well, I reckon you want me to get on with it and tell you what happened, so I reckon I'll tell you. I was sitting out there in the shed one evening, not doing too much.
If you're just joining us, my guest is screenwriter, director, actor, and musician Billy Bob Thornton. I want to squeeze in one other scene of yours, and this is from a movie called A Simple Plan. You starred in it. This is about three people who steal money they find at the site of a plane crash. And, you know, they're a little conflicted about it, but they go through with it, and in their attempts to cover their tracks, things go terribly bad. This is a scene where your brother is dropping you off at his house, at your house, and you're wondering how money is going to change your life. Now, you're playing somebody who's kind of mentally slow in this, and who isn't physically attractive, and you know your glasses are held together by masking tape around the nose piece.
Okay.
I don't you think somebody will marry me if I'm rich?
You don't need money for that.
Hank.
Hey, come on. What about, what was her name? Carrie Richards? She liked you even though you were broke, Dick.
Well, her, yeah. That was a whole different deal. That was, her friends, they pitched in $100 altogether and bet her that she wouldn't go study with me for a month.
Jesus, Jacob, I thought you guys had a thing.
Well, that wasn't that bad. Actually, it was kind of cool. We used to walk around together a lot, you know, take walks, you know, and, we talked about all kind of cool stuff. I held hands with her one time. We were walking around. And my hand sweated so much, I kind of had to let it go. I was nervous, I guess. But it was cool. When the month was over, she, kind of, she'd say hi to me sometimes in the hallway when I'd see her. She didn't have to do that. That's cool of her. God, Hank, you know, I've never even kissed a girl before. So, you know, if being rich will change that, I'm all for it. I don't care. I just want to feel it, you know. I just want to know what people do, you know. I don't care if it's because of the money. Hank. I'm gonna be happy now, right?
Sure you are. We all are.
Yeah, that's right, we all are.
This is a very moving scene in which the character reveals a lot about himself. Could you talk a little bit about doing this scene and not turning it into a big fireworks kind of speech, but playing it really low-key?
You know, first of all, as an actor, you're trying to be realistic. And if you're talking to your brother in a car about something like that, it is going to be low-key. And sometimes, you know, I mean, well, when an actor tries to make a point of something, it's like being at home pretending you're like a rock star in the mirror or something, you know. It's like that's not the way you should do it. You know, you should just kind of talk or do whatever. Do whatever it is, you know. And that scene, though, it was an emotional scene for me. So what I did, really, in that scene, because it was, in a sense, autobiographical, I put a couple of, there were a few lines that I put in there about holding the girl's hand. It was so sweaty, I was embarrassed by it and stuff like that. I had a time when I was in, you know, elementary school and junior high school, when it was sort of that way for me. And so that scene was very, very close to me. And as opposed to trying to put anything more into the scene, I was actually trying to hold back because I felt a lot of emotion about it. So I was actually trying to not get emotional. So maybe that's the way it worked, why it worked out that way.
One last question. What's the most ridiculous thing that's ever been written about you that wasn't true?
Well, most of the stuff that's written about me and my wife is not true. It's all either from being misquoted, from joking with people. In print, if you joke with somebody, they don't see how your face looks at the time, or they don't, whatever. There's this whole thing about I'm the reincarnation of Ben Franklin, which I don't doubt, but I didn't say it in seriousness, really. I mean, I feel very close to Ben Franklin. I feel very connected to him and stuff like that, but I'm not positive I was Ben Franklin. Anyway, I think probably the most ridiculous thing written about me is that I live in a dungeon. particularly given the fact that that's like my, as I was saying earlier, my worst nightmare.
Some furniture.
Castle or, yeah. But, and then, my blood is in this little sort of, locket that my wife wears around her neck, and I have hers on one also. And from that, suddenly you're like this sort of weird blood-sucking vampire.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, and I've told people this before, if you put that in a movie, if Mel Gibson gave some girl a little locket of his blood in a movie, it'd be really romantic. You do it in real life, you're a weirdo.
Billy Bob Thornton talking earlier this year with Terry Gross. His film Monsters Ball is still in theaters. Bandits and The Man Who Wasn't There have just been released on home video and DVD. I'm Margo Adler, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. Also sponsored in part by Nonesuch Records, now featuring Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, the new album by Wilco, available at Barnes & Noble music locations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, British cross-dressing comic Eddie Izzard. He had roles in the films Shadow of a Vampire and The Velvet Goldmine. He's currently starring in the new Peter Bogdanovich film, The Cat's Meow, as Charlie Chaplin. And Ken Tucker reviews When I Was Cruel, the new CD by Elvis Costello. This is Fresh Air. I'm Margo Adler. Eddie Izzard has been called the queen of comedy, the coolest straight man alive in high heels, frosted hair, and drop-dead red lipstick. But as Ron Wertheimer wrote in the New York Times, the first thing you notice after you notice that he's wearing high heels is how smart he is. His interests range from ancient history to society's latest offenses, and his mind leaps from one thing to another in an extreme of consciousness monologue. Eddie Izzard has appeared in the movies Shadow of a Vampire, The Velvet Goldmine, and Mystery Men. In the new Peter Bogdanovich film, The Cat's Meow, set in the world of 1920s showbiz celebrities, gossip columnists, and writers, Izzard plays Charlie Chaplin.
Don't tell me Eleanor Glynn has arrived on time. Good God, perhaps even early.
Oh, all right then. Hello, you little bastard.
It's the little I object to.
I see your young passion flame is not accompanying you.
Lita, is she not here? I seem to have forgotten her. Let's keep it that way, shall we?
Izzard is one of England's stars of stand-up comedy, but through films and comedy, he's also become popular in the U.S. His one-man show, Dressed to Kill, had a successful run in the States in 1998 and was later adapted into an HBO special. Terry Gross spoke with Izzard 2 years ago. They started with an excerpt of the special.
The Founding Fathers in 16... They set off from Plymouth and landed in Plymouth. How lucky is that, eh?
Get there and go.
This is Plymouth. This is Plymouth. We set off from Plymouth. Go. We've gone round in a circle, lads. Back on the boats. Come on. This is Plymouth, too. My God, there's two Plymouths. Back on the boats. Eventually, they get to America and go, ah, this is where this is the place that God has brought us to. We can raise a family here. We can practice our religion. There's nobody here. Excuse me. There's nobody here. No human soul on this land. Who are these people over there with a big... What's that feathers stuff on their heads doing? Could you... What? No, we weren't expecting you. Our God has brought us here, and... No, we don't want any of your food, thank you very much. Just put some clothes on, for God's sake. Have you no shame? Meanwhile, that winter... Excuse me, do you have any food? I love all this stuff on your head. It's a fantastic idea, really. Very adaptable, aren't they, the immigrants? Yes, yes. Lovely. Got your own religion? Fantastic. We got one too. Thanks. Hello. Lovely. Yes, we were trying to grow bananas. Didn't really work, but thanks. Thanks for the food, anyway. Yes, there's more of us coming, but we all keep our promises.
Now, I think your early comedy performances were as a street performer in England. And from what I've read, it sounds like in your early act, you rode a unicycle, you did sword fighting in the street, worked with trick handcuffs. Were you planning on joining a circus?
No. It's the problem with the street is you cannot do, you have to do physical situation comedy. Being really analytical, which I gained from coming out as being a transvestite and having to self-analyze myself, I gained this gift of intensive analysis. So I analyzed the street because I went down, I thought, I'll get the street in 2 weeks and then I'll be doing shows. People can give me some money. I can earn a bit of money this way. But it took me a year. And people will not respond to spoken word. If you go out and do stand-up, unless you had a huge amplifier behind you, you cannot do sketches. You can't do sketches or spoken word because there's not enough glue out there. There's not enough... the audience won't stick around for that. They need to see something physical, situation in front of you. So that's why juggling and magic and stuff works. Visual things. Visual things really kill out on the street. But the spoken word, it just gets lost and people can't quite hear, and then there's no sense of atmosphere, and there's too much other noise going on of wind and rain and cars and people and other people laughing. And so you couldn't do stand-up out there. You had to do stuff that was sword fighting or these really weird tricks and fake knife throwing used to do, or getting on a big unicycle and getting out of a pair of handcuffs. That ended up as my big, stupid show. I wasn't really into the show, but I could talk a lot of inane, strange comedy in between it, and I could lace it in between the show. And they would stay because I was on a unicycle and I might die, basically.
Exactly.
It was like right. A car crash thing. They were thinking, this is a car crash waiting to happen. Maybe he'll die. You know, even on a tough day when it's raining and snowing, I'd still sort of hang around in case I died. I thought that was my essential glue. It's a sort of, will he die? Oh, he hasn't died. All right, let's give him fivepence. So So that was the show I ended up with. But what I really liked on The Street, what I really learned was how to start a show. And in starting a show, you have to build it up from nothing. And so there's about 20 minutes which it takes to build up enough of an audience so that you can actually start. Because if you start with too small an audience, you never actually build further from that. It's quite complicated.
So how would you start the audience?
Well, it was quite often it'd be just getting... Well, I'd put down tea cozies. I had these tea cozies that looked like animals. They were a duck tea cozy and a... you call them tea cozies that you put over...
The little quilted thing you put over a teapot to keep it warm.
Yeah, that's it. And... there was a duck and a penguin and a hippopotamus, and I just bought these. And I used to put them on the ground very slowly. And I discovered this thing. Well, I didn't discover. I noticed other people doing it on the street, that if you put something very slowly down with a lot of focus on the street, people will watch you doing it. It will draw their attention because they think, well, what are you doing? If you just have a lot of focus and you put it just very gently down the street. So I was doing this, and I'd take about 20 minutes to put these out. And people would just sort of form around thinking, well, he's going to do something with these tea cozies. And then I'd never do anything with them. So I just managed to build up an audience that way. Or I'd talk to people, and I'd sort of... In the end, I was actually just standing on the street and just spieling to people. I could just go on and on and on and build up scenarios. And people would just walk across in front of me, sort of ignoring the show while I was trying to build a show. And I'd say, this is Janine and this is Sarah. They're dressed up at the moment as they're playing characters. I've employed them to do this. As you can see them walking through, they'll ignore me. They'll ignore me because they're very good. They're always in their characters. They never sort of come out of character. So I'd impose this scenario. These are just two women walking across, and I would impose the idea that they were actors portraying two women who happen to be walking across. And then I'd say they would change. In 5 minutes, they'll come back as different characters. Then I'd pick two other people and say, that's them. That's them now. And everyone knew it was rubbish, but it was quite neat because it sort of worked. And I could do this imposing scenarios thing and sort of get a certain atmosphere going as if I was controlling things, as if I... You have to use what's going on and look as if you're the master of ceremonies in this show, but in fact, it was just stuff happening around you.
Eddie Izzard talking with Terry Gross about his work in comedy and films. We'll have more of this conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to Terry's interview with Eddie Izzard. He currently plays Charlie Chaplin in the new Peter Bogdanovich movie, The Cat's Meow.
Your mother died when you were six, and after that you were sent to boarding school.
Yeah.
Whenever I see a movie that's set in a British boarding school, there's always an element of sadism in it, where the older boys pick on the younger boys, and it seems like it was a pretty uncomfortable place to be for a lot of people. How was it for you?
It's the classic one of the Tom Brown School Days, which has this thing called fagging, which is, basically people work as servants for the older boys, and they can beat the hell out of you. And I think the amount of bullying or whatever that went on was typical for any school. It didn't, you know, there was some that went on, but it wasn't overtly in that sort of stuff you've seen in films. The first school I went to, I really didn't like. I just didn't like... Well, it was. I was six, so I just it wasn't a great place to go, and it was a bit like being on a desert island. But the second and the third, the second school I went to had a more healthy place. Which first one was in Wales, South Wales, and the second one was in the south of England, and that one had a much more. The headmaster there was a decent guy, and. It was a generally positive place. There was a certain amount of bullying that went on, but, you know, that was just what happens in schools. And then by the time I got to the third school, which is kind of probably harder to deal with, I was already, like a rock and emotionally. Like, you know, I wouldn't cry. No one was going to sort of give me a hard time because I was going to give them a hard time first. So I was already built to resist any problems that would come up.
When you were in boarding school, were you able to use humor in self-defense?
Yeah, it was absolutely. It was to get popular at school and get popular with girls and just to get popular, basically, to get more popular. Well, because I used to, when I was up to 13, I used to play football, and I lived for football, and that was my kind of That was which you call soccer. But that was the thing I love, and this is why I'm a male tomboy. This is football and makeup. I was in the first team, and you know, and it was school matches, and that's what I lived for. Then I went to the next school. They didn't play football, so and I wasn't very good at the other sports. So I just I lost a center of where I was going, and even though I liked acting and stuff, I hadn't had any parts up to this point. So I started pushing slightly more on this acting stuff, and then I started developing that I could do this comedy in the classroom and be witty and do those lines that you throw at the teacher when they're in between a comment. You can just drop a line in that really works and cracks the class up, and that was working well. And then there were no girls at school until the sixth form, so I was about 17. And then a few girls turn up in this. It was bizarre. So you have one girl for 20 boys. So it just didn't. I didn't talk to any girls for a long time because I wasn't playing sports. I wasn't head of the school. I wasn't. I was just some guy wandering around with greasy hair and acne, basically. But the comedy got me out of that comedy because I found that I could use that in the class, and it just it was a social tool, really.
So when was the first time you actually acted on the impulse to wear makeup or dresses?
Well, it got a bit weird because my mum died, and so I and there was no sisters in the family, so I had no access to anything until... Well, there was bits of... there was occasional stuff at school, but really I got to college, and then when I got to college, I was doing theatre shows, and there's a whole wardrobe department there. So I thought, hey, you know, I'm running this show. I can go in this wardrobe department and just say, well, let's borrow this for the moment.
Did anyone ever walk in on you before you were out and you had to, like, make up an explanation about why you were wearing a dress?
No, that didn't happen. I once got some kids sort of chasing after me saying, why are you wearing a dress? Why are you wearing makeup? And they were trying to. I was trying to go home, and they were trying to follow me. So I thought, I can't go home now because they'll know where I live. So I thought I started wandering off in a different direction, and they kept chasing after me until I thought, right, I'm going to talk to them. So I stopped and said, look, you want to know? You want to talk to me? Come and talk to me. And then they just ran off. So that taught me something. I thought, oh yeah, they're actually everyone's just scared of their own shadow. But that's that kind of bullying thing because they were pushing, and so I turned around and said, okay, what do you want to talk about? And then they ran. And I find this with little, small, young children, girls and boys. If I'm wearing makeup, they'll come up to me and say, you're a girl. This thing which, for a boy, when you're at school, is supposed to be the big thing you can't be.
Oh, there's the biggest insult.
Yes, and that's the one that's undefendable. You can't, and you have to say, no, I'm not. And they go, yes, you are. You're a girl. And when I'm wearing makeup now, and little kids will come up to me, you're a girl. And I go, yeah. And then they stop and they think, hang on. That's supposed to work, and they said, "No, you're a girl." I go, "Yeah, yeah, I am." And then you can just see the confusion on their faces, and it's almost like they're getting into a group huddle and saying, "Look, surely we should say he's a girl. He should say no, and then we've got him." But if you're saying yes, that's denying the whole. We've got no argument to go to, and they could just see that they can't deal with it. They have to wander off, shaking their heads.
Did you ever have to tell a girlfriend who didn't know that you were a transvestite that you were, and then she had a react to the fact that you see yourself as a male lesbian, which might have been confusing to her?
Yes, I think it is slightly more difficult in relationships. But the main, because women think, well, how does that reflect on me? What do you think of me, or what will other people think that of me if I'm going out with someone who's transvestite? And it gets a little bit confusing for a woman in that area. But generally, I thought most women would just say, well, that's it, I don't want to talk to you. But in fact, a lot of women are very positive and supportive and curious about it, being out about it, being TV. So, it's a lot different to what I thought it would be like. A lot better, a lot more positive, way more positive. If I had my life over again, I said I would be TV. Like, it seemed like it would be so much simpler, seeing as I fancy women, just to be straight, you know. But it's actually taught me so much, and it's so much of a quest thing. You've learned so much. You gain so much in confidence and understanding how human nature works by being TV and having to come out, or being gay or being lesbian, the whole coming out thing, that I just find it really positive.
Let me me ask you a shopping question. There's a lot of like hip boutiques or something, and I'll walk into, and people just kind of look at me funny because I maybe like don't look quite like hip enough to qualify to shop there, or maybe it's because I'm like short and they know nothing in their store is going to fit me. But you know, I do get some strange looks, like I don't, like I'm not really a member of the club, you know, that
right.
that really hip clothes club, and they know it. What kind of looks do you get when you go shopping?
I have trained myself not to take in looks.
Mm-hmm.
I trained myself to think Elizabeth Taylor, and I remember hearing about, I thought that would come in handy. This is Elizabeth Taylor, but you know, about in the 50s or 60s. I read about her turning up, Richard Burton was filming, and she turned up in, he was filming in Italy, so she turns up in Italy, gets the chief of police to take her out to the set. So it was screaming motorbikes and sirens and everything. She turns up and gets out in some sort of coat, out of a Rolls Royce and out of police cars, and just thought, well, yeah, that's a way to do an entrance. And I found, like, trying on clothes in shops, if I go up and I say, I'm a bloke, I'm going to try on this skirt. If I say, can I try on this skirt? And I think I found that most people in shops go, well, I don't think that's possible at all. We'd have to kill you first. Surely that's illegal in several states and hangable. Can we hang them for that? But I found that if I say, I'm trying this on in there, I'm going now, then they go, ah, fine, right, okay. Because I'm just trying it on in a cubicle. I just want to buy their clothes. They want to sell their clothes. So it's a confidence thing, and I found that if I asked, then I would get rejected. But if I said I am doing it, they go, fine, you do it. And that's an interesting attitude, and I have to be just really upfront and very knowledgeable. Like, quite often you get these people who go, can I help you? Very quickly, especially if men go up to makeup counters. And I have to say, yes, I want these lipsticks are no good. I don't like those. Those are kind of mushy, right? And I have to be very knowledgeable in my area of makeup just so that they pull back a bit and don't get in my face. Well, these are very nice. Who is it for? So, it's for me, and I want this, that. Don't want that. That's rubbish. That's way overpriced. And you can may as well burn that lot because it's useless. And I kind of get kind of aggressive in that way so that they just back out of my face.
Would this work for me, do you think?
Yeah, I think you have to assume you have to think Elizabeth Taylor. You have to think, or a person that's going to work for you. You have to just come in and be very disdainful. If you feel you're getting disdain towards you, double the disdain back. And if they say, can I help you? You say, I'm sure you can't.
You see, this is how being a theater person can really come in handy.
Yes, well, exactly.
Because I'm not good at that kind of stuff. I mean, I'm not good at, like, thinking Elizabeth Taylor. I can't really pull that off.
I think you can if you practice. Elizabeth Taylor might not work for you, but it worked for me. It's just, you've got to think someone who you think, right, I'm going to think that person. And try to stay, just be... Think, okay, people are going to give me hassle, so I'm not going to assume it because you don't want to attack if someone's actually trying to be helpful
right,
or whatever.
Right.
But you just want to be up there and in that kind of high eyebrow kind of, yes, I don't know if your shop is really worthy of me. That's what you really need to think of. Listen to Walkman is a very good way of doing it. I found going into those shops when I first started earning a bit of money and I sort of going in there and there's one person in there and it's very quiet and everything, you pull out socks and there's sort of, you know, 100 quid,
right.
100 pounds, and you go, gee, I can't even breathe on these socks. And so I found that I would just put on a Walkman and I'd be very kind of like, as if I'm a designer, because that's what look you come into. You come into, like, you're a designer. You just say, I do this thing, this is my job. So just be very quick and pull out the stuff and throw it back, and oh, this is rubbish. And then just walk out, and then... And if you adopt that attitude, they'll have to bow down to it because all they're doing is adopting an attitude of snottiness towards anyone who comes in. So you just got to crank your ego up, get on the raised eyebrow thing, and a Walkman can really work because you can just listen to music and they could be saying, "Can I help you?" And they can come right up to your face and you just ignore them. Because when people say, "Can I help you?" I never look at them now. They say, "Can I help you?" Because then you go, "Probably not, I don't know." You know, you just get into a lost thing. So when they say, can I help you? I just go, no, I don't think you can. And I just make sure that it's that one of the last things that's on my mind is talking to them, because I just it takes me into a low-status thing, and they must know what they're doing there.
Well, I appreciate all the advice.
It does work. You just have to practice it. If at first it doesn't work, just keep thinking, okay. Keep in the zone.
Well, Eddie Izzard, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks very much.
You know. And then I had to chat girls up, and I'd never had the ability. You know, I'd only tagged them before. Now I had to use verbal skills. Susan, you don't have the ability at 13 to be able to say, Susan, I saw you in the classroom. The sun came from behind the clouds, and a shaft of sunlight caught your hair, golden framing your face. Your eyes burned blue fire into my soul. I immediately read the words of Dostoevsky and Karl Marx. And in the words of Albert Schweitzer, I fancy you. But no. No, at 13, you're just going, hello, Sue. I saw you in the room. I've got legs, you know. Have you? Oh, yeah, there they are. Do you like bread? Look, I got a French stick. Yeah, French loaf. Boom. Bah. I love you.
That was a clip from Eddie Izzard's 1998 show, Dressed to Kill. He is currently playing Charlie Chaplin in the new Peter Bogdanovich movie, The Cat's Meow. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new Elvis Costello CD, When I Was Cruel. This is Fresh Air. Elvis Costello has spent the past few years collaborating with non-rock musicians, ranging from Burt Bacharach to classical music vocalist Anne-Sophie Van Otter. His new album, When I Was Cruel, reunites Costello with two members of his first rock group, The Attractions. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the new album returns Costello to his roots.
I spied through the spirit of curiosity all the scandals of each vain monstrosity. I gossip and I pry and I insinuate. If the failure is great, then it tends to fascinate. A tornado dropped the...
There's a sense in which Elvis Costello began his career in the 70s as an act of punk-inspired irony. Declan McManus took the name Elvis Costello as a way of invoking Elvis Presley while spitting out his own articulate bile with his band The Attractions. Costello made one terrific rock album after another, right up through Blood and Chocolate in 1986. After that, restless and adventurous, he shed his band and began a series of collaborations that ranged outside of rock and roll. So for him now, pushing 50, to get, as he puts it in his liner notes, rude and vivid again with, quote, more distorted tremolo guitar on this record than any other album of mine, unquote. Well, Costello is applying a fresh coating of irony to his original irony. The result is at once passionately exhilarating and coolly calculated. Nowhere is this more evident than on the back-to-back concept songs Spooky Girlfriend and Tear Off Your Own Head, It's a Doll's Revolution. Spooky Girlfriend is Costello's take on a horny rock and roll Svengali controlling a young female pop idol.
I want a girl to make a mess, to do no wrong, she must confess, and then perhaps hitch up her dress. Cause when the flash bulbs explode, she is such a sensitive.
By contrast, Tear Off Your Own Head is about the rebellion of the exploited girl singer. In the metaphor of the song, the woman reduced to a doll tears off her head, that is to say, her face, her image, to reveal her true nature.
Who drives your eyes as you cry real tears? Who knows who cares what an imitation is? Only you could. You can paint his nails, make him wear high heels. Why waste time altering the hemline? Or do you tear off your own?
As a devotee of Costello, when he's simultaneously most vehement in his melody and adroit as opposed to merely clever in his lyrics, I think the best song on this collection is its thrilling leadoff cut called 45. Costello deploys the title number as everything from a man's age to the RPM speed at which small vinyl records used to be played. Open your ears now.
Bells are chiming for victory. There's a page back in history, 45. They came back to the world that they fought for. Didn't turn out just like they thought, 45. Here is your song to say, to do the measuring. What do you lose? What do you gain?
Not all of When I Was Cruel is as good as that, and for a reason suggested by the title. When Costello first appeared on the scene, he was a new variation on a British archetype, the angry young man. He owned up to acts of arrogance and abusiveness, and often carried out his image off stage. The middle-aged, mellowed Costello sees this behavior for what it was, a very well-crafted pose. But in making that recognition, it renders the new collection's so-called rude and vivid music slightly less rude and less vivid, if still capable of delivering a precise musical jab and punch.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly.
I heard something peculiar said, perhaps has got a shot and now is dead. 45.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Paris Luna. Terry Gross returns on Monday. I'm Margo Adler.
45.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Franklin Flyer, a novel set during the 30s and 40s by Nicholas Christopher, author of A Trip to the Stars, the National Endowment for the Arts, and by National Geographic, featuring travel products including guidebooks, maps, magazines, and trips, available in stores nationwide or online at nationalgeographic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss the late jazz musician and composer Charles Mingus with his wife Sue Graham Mingus, also actor Bill Paxton. He's now directing the new film Frailty. Join us for the next Fresh Air.